Welcome to Theatre Voice, and I'm very excited today because I'm in the offices of Private Eye, which you might think is a funny place to come and do a theatre interview, but we're here to talk about A Bunch of Amateurs, one of the funniest plays I've seen for ages, and I'm with the writers, Nick Newman and Ian Hislop. So, welcome to Theatre Voice.
Thank you very much. I'm Ian.
And I'm Nick.
Obviously, it's not just plays you write. In fact, it may just be play. I'm not sure who asked. But how do you actually write together? Because this partnership goes back over 30 years, doesn't it?
It does indeed, yes. But we actually sit down in this very room and sit at that little computer there and curse it because it very rarely works and somehow manage to grind out some words. But we've always worked together in the room together. I know lots of writers, one writes one draft and then the other writes the next draft. But for us, it's always been a fun exercise. It's just it's something away from what we actually normally do in our professional lives.
Do you have a particular way of working where one of you has one role and one has the other?
No, we literally do it line by line. And we try and make each other laugh. I mean, that is the essential bit. I mean, we do plan it out and we do the proper sort of where are we going now and what are they like? But essentially, the fun bit of it is performing. And because we've known each other since we were very, very young, there's no offence anymore. You can literally say, well, that's a terrible idea, Nick. Really quite poor. And get away with it.
So it does actually go back to school, doesn't it?
It does, yes. I was a couple of years older than Ian.
It doesn't show.
Bless you. Bless you. I've got a big portrait in the attic, I think. but no, Ian was a very precocious talent at school. He was a couple of years younger than me. But he was with a group of friends doing very, very funny work in school plays. We did The Government Inspector. Mm. And Ian and his friends were absolutely brilliant in it. And myself and another contemporary, Simon Park, we were encouraged by our English master to do a school review. And it was just natural that we should include Ian and his gang in it because they were the funniest people in the school.
But you were both writing.
Yes, and I mean, Nick and Simon we looked up to because they were sort of the big boys and they were and they were sort of funny in a way we hadn't thought it was possible to be, in sort of slightly rude and amusing way. And Simon and Nick went off to Oxford. So obviously I should have looked at the curriculum and thought seriously about the course, but I thought I must get there because they're up there and they look as though they're having fun. Mm. And indeed they were. They'd set up a humorous magazine and they were doing reviews. And when I got to Oxford, Nick luckily was still there, and we started working together again there.
And as we say, this has gone on for 30 years.
Quite long enough.
Plus, and has included, obviously, writing for Private Eye, and obviously loads of television, but mostly sketches, but there have been some more sustained programmes too, haven't there? Because I'm looking how we get from that to a play, or whether there are other plays.
We originally wrote lots of sketches together for television for the Harry Enfield show, and we created characters like Tim Nice But Dim, and we did a lot of sketch writing. And then we started writing little half-hour plays for Dawn French.
Yes, we were asked to do work on a series called Murder Most Horrid, which was a sort of little mini film industry for a while in the early 1990s. We'd started off writing really together, working on Spitting Image, and that was the first time I think we ever actually collaborated truly as writers. We'd done some stuff for our university magazine, and I contributed cartoons because that's my other hat that I wear. I'd done cartoons for Ian's mag, but it was Spitting Image which got us going. And after about 5 or 6 years of doing sort of 30-second gobbits of puppets hitting themselves over the heads, we thought it'd be great to write just something with a bit of character, where it required a bit of acting. And we were very lucky to be asked to do these Dawn French series. The very first thing we wrote together was for Maureen Lipman and Simon Cadell, called Briefcase Encounter, which was one of the best things I think we've ever written, just straight out of the box. But
I really wish I'd seen that. So how long was that then? Was that a half hour or more?
That was a half hour. And it was really a bit like The Office. It was about how boring offices are and how people try and spend the whole time having meetings. And so it was all about briefcases and a sort of thwarted love affair in the middle. But it was lovely. And Simon Cadell, of course, was absolutely fantastic.
Much, much, much lamented. So how do we get from there to this play? Or are there other plays on the way, or is this the very first one?
No, the idea of actually doing something for the theatre came out of having written a film for David Parfitt, who we've collaborated with on a few things. I mean, the last of which was Wipers Times, which was a 90-minute film for television about the First World War and a satirical trench newspaper. And that was a full-on drama. And David's next idea was, well, we've done that. Why don't you do a version of this film you've already written, but do it for the stage? And that was a brilliant idea, because Bunch of Amateurs is about an amateur dramatic company. It's about using a small space. It's about what theatre can do. And we ended up doing a play in a small theatre. And it works, I think, you know, the best it could.
Yes, the Watermill is so a shoo-in, isn't it, for that village hall in Stratford St John. Stratford St John in Suffolk. Is there a Stratford St John?
We've made that one up.
I thought you probably did. Yeah. And I think that's why one of the reasons it works so brilliantly, because we feel we're the audience in that village hall, I think. And I absolutely love that. But then that's the Watermill for you. It's that sort of theatre anyway, you know. The things that fit there better than anywhere else. So, but we'll come back to that. I knew that it was a film, though I'd never seen it, but it wasn't originally your story, was it? And you sort of taken it. It's had a long journey to get to where it is on stage.
Yes, it was originally a story by Jonathan Gershfield and John Ross, and they had written this quite different storyline, which had sort of, as film scripts often do, hit the buffers a bit. And we were asked by David Parfitt, who's a very old friend of ours, to have a look at it and see what we thought. And we said, well, we'll give it a read and give you some thoughts for free, but if you want us to do any work, then, you know, then employ us. Luckily, he agreed with all our points. We loved the story. We thought the basic story of the fish out of water Hollywood star coming to do Amdrams was quite inspired. But the mechanics of it and how it worked and the characters and the various sort of subplots within it, we completely rewrote.
I think you've sort of said what it's about now. But the whole point of the Bunch of Amateurs is this is what your leading character, Jefferson Steele, if I got that right, the fading Hollywood action hero, would call the people he finds in this village hall where he's landed up thanks to the hazy grasp of photography of his American agent. That character, I suppose, was already there. So tell me about how you developed the characters.
I think what we wanted to do is say, isn't the amateur theatre ridiculous? It is, but it's more than that. And the story of this is a professional actor coming to realise just what the amateur theatre has that he'd lost, which is an essential love for the theatre and a belief that people coming together and putting on a play is worthwhile. So we tried to add that into the story. And I mean, I did Amdrams in a local barn when I was a teenager, and I loved it. My friend and I, who later became a proper actor, but I don't think he's ever had as much fun as we had there. And so I tried to input all of that. And Nick and I did plays together at school. I mean, Nick played a radical in The Massacre of Peterloo. Imagine how moved you'd be by Nick's exhortations.
I would.
I'm very much the person on stage who comes on and then forgets their lines and goes off and has a bit of a weep. That's exactly what I did the very first production. So I do feel the panic and the nerves that our lead character Jefferson feels when confronted with a real audience. It's absolutely terrifying. But it's actually, just on reflection, we had actually written a sort of play within a play once before for Dawn French. In as part of the Murder Most Horrid series, we wrote a sort of version of the Mousetrap called the Cat Flap. The programme was called He Died a Death, and it had a fantastic cast, including Tony Slattery and Kenneth Cranham and Dawn, of course, Stephen Moore. But it was about a sort of a creaky old West End murder mystery where one of the characters is murdered in at the end of the first half, and it's a whodunit within the theatre, and it happens to be a police outing to see the theatre that day, so they all have to have a go at solving the murder. But that sort of got us into the idea, and when we were writing the play version of this, is that a lot of our friends who are actors, you often don't really know where they end and the acting begins. They're fantastic, consummate storytellers, wonderful at anecdotes, but you think, did this really happen, or is this just you embroidering the truth, or whatever? And we've always enjoyed that, and we've tried to add that into the Bunch of Amateurs script.
What I love about it is the fact that you do sustain the story. There are all these characters that you know and recognise, but they are genuinely lovable, even including Jefferson. He's a big bear of a man. Mitchell Mullen, he's this huge bear of a man, and that really works. And he sort of dwarfs everybody else on stage, so he looks like the larger-than-life star. So where did you find him, then?
I didn't even know his work. I mean, the incredible thing I find with, you know, because I don't know a huge amount about the mechanics of the stage, is David Parfitt says, oh, yes, we'll get a brilliant cast. And you think, well, how do you know that, David? And he just says, the level of talent out there, you know, below the line that you recognise, you know, British theatre actors, they're really, really good.
Yeah, that's interesting you should say that, because you might go to the theatre anywhere in this country, you might just see a bad play, you might be unlucky enough to see a bad production, but you really won't see much bad acting because the level is incredible, I think. Mm.
Yeah, well, I mean, we're just incredibly lucky. We've got people like Sarah Moyle, who's playing Mary, who runs the B&B. But a couple of weeks ago, she was up for a soap comedy award on television because she's just a brilliant comic actress. But we're just lucky with all the cast, and we've been staggered by the depth that, you know, you can... you just start casting and suddenly you've got a play full of wonderful people.
Did you go to rehearsal much? I mean, did it change at all during rehearsal, or was it set in stone by the time the cast got it?
We went to the first read-through, and we'd had a couple of read-throughs before the first read-through with our cast, and we'd done it with friends and just to see how it sounded. But, gosh, the relief when we heard our cast do it was just, it was just wonderful, because it was the first time we'd heard, particularly in the part of Jefferson Steele, the lines that we had written going right back to the film, when we wrote the film. A lot of those lines hadn't made it onto the screen because of the problems we had with our star, which are sort of quite well documented.
Oh, that's Burt Reynolds.
That's Burt, who was absolutely delightful, but he wasn't very well while he was filming in February on the Isle of Man. And so
you have to have some sympathy.
You do, I think I would have walked off set quite a lot if I had been in his shoes. But no, he wasn't 100%. And
okay,
that's the cagiest answer I've ever heard, and quite right too. So some of those big set piece speeches that Jefferson delivered, we'd never heard, and it was just great to have someone doing it. And it did mean that when it came to the sort of jokes about whether you can learn your lines or not, we did put in a lot of the things we'd learnt on the film into the play.
So that's what you meant about life imitating art, imitating life. And there's a note you put in the programme, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, it was a very strange situation to be on the Isle of Man with an actor playing the part of a person who can't remember his lines, who has to have cue cards everywhere for the quite basic lines. Bert, you know, worked very hard to try and sort of get over this. It's a different tradition. The English actors arrived. We had our English cast for the film included Sir Derek Jacobi, Imelda Staunton, and Samantha Bond. And
wow.
Yes, I mean, it's the cream of the cream, you know, it's wonderful. And they have been doing Lear all their lives. So Samantha Bond would, you know, so you'd say, how are you going to do the Fool song? And she would just do it on a sixpence. Bert had never done Shakespeare. We had our leading man who had never done Shakespeare, and Derek Jacobi, who's playing an amateur, who was going to do Lear on stage the next year. You know, so it was a very curious situation. But there were lots of elements of Bert's stardom which we were able to sort of pick up on, and they have found their way into the script. Because I think even he would probably find them quite funny in looking at them objectively.
I think he ought to come over and see it, actually. There is a wonderful moment where the words are written on someone's back, I can't remember what they're, which puts me in mind of the course acting shows where the words get written on all sorts of things and sometimes on playing cards that you lose when you deal them.
That is quite a familiar thing, I think, on the stage. My acting friends said, oh, yes, we've done a lot of things where you're sitting at a desk and you're looking in your desk for something and there's
it's my lines.
Yes, well, I do remember a whole lot of people in a pantomime coming on with placards, and they were supposed to be some sort of, you know, sort of protest pantomime mob, and accidentally one or two of them did turn their thing round. You could see all their lines on the back.
Well, we were unsure. We thought when we were writing it that is this really believable? And I've been reassured by those in the biz that this is a common occurrence. Well, the other thing that we learnt from Bert, and I didn't know this happened, but it's now, you know, I've heard that this happens quite a lot on stage now, is that people going on with earpieces. And I read, in fact, Angela Lansbury was saying that she hadn't used an earpiece for Blythe Spirit. Is it Blythe Spirit that she's doing?
Yeah, she's Madame Alcarty, she's playing. Yeah.
And so this happened with us with Bert, that, in fact, I think it was Sir Derek's partner, Richard Clifford, who was helping Bert with his Shakespeare, and he was sort of off stage feeding these lines in, which we thought, well, you can have a bit of fun with that, and we have.
You certainly, that's made it into the final cut then, as they say, hasn't it? You might be hiding your light under a bushel if we don't say that the film, A Bunch of Amateurs, was the Royal Command film of the year 2008,
Royal Command performance, as though Her Majesty had personally asked for it, though the evening went rather well, and I was sitting four rows behind the royal party, and they laughed, even at the bits that involved swearing. So they obviously thought there was something. I mean, the swearing's in context, I hate
totally
to add.
I think probably the Duke of Edinburgh enjoyed that bit in particular.
Well, it seems to have got requested all over again at the palace. She's obviously got the DVD and is watching it like mad.
Well, that's what we were told. A piece appeared in the Daily Mail saying that the Queen had requested a copy of the film to show to her family and staff at Sandringham. So we were, well, who's to argue with the Daily Mail?
quite. But what I've been writing and thinking that, although 2008 is not that long ago, it seems to me that I don't remember having Twitter then. I mean, you sort of managed to fit in all the online fun of modern life. I mean, I love the idea of somebody coming to rehearsal by Skype because I couldn't make it.
That was Nick's idea. Yeah. No, I mean, we wanted to write an updated play. And actually, I mean, the central problem at the beginning is to make sure that he stays. He's a Hollywood star. He's got to be embarrassed into staying, even though he's made a mistake and ended up in an amateur place. And the only way he'll stay is if he's embarrassed. Luckily, modern life has infinitely more avenues of embarrassment than it did 6 years ago. So the fact that he's trending on Twitter, the fact that everything he says is out there, means he can't get out. You are now trapped. Everything's public. So, yes, we tried to make it more up-to-date, but actually that all helped us make the play more believable.
Yeah, it was a gift, wasn't it, then? But it's all there, and that's what I really love that. And I presume the idea of the sort of mistaken concept of the sex romp making it into the Sun, that probably was there before. That's another little double bind he finds himself in, isn't it?
Yes, well, that's another of our obsessions, which is the press and the press getting it wrong. No, I used to be a journalist, and one of the reasons I gave up journalism was because of the horror of getting things wrong, and people get things wrong all the time, and it's part and parcel of journalism, people getting the wrong end of the stick. And it's been a bit of a theme in some of the things we've written over the years.
Yeah, but there has to be that, yeah, the thing about the prurience of the press. But again, it works. It all works. And where I think the idea of you going back as far as you go is that it seems to flow. I mean, but this is down to your cast as well, because their delivery is incredible, that you can't believe line, tops line, tops line, tops line. And then you're laughing and you think, well, I actually hear the next line because it's so funny, and the whole audience around me were just sort of hugging themselves. So.
Well, that's incredibly pleasing. I mean, we found, for example, with the newspaper thing, I mean, there's a speech that the solicitor, who's responsible, I mean, he gave the story to the newspaper out of jealousy, and then...
Yeah, we should explain that he's actually in the show. Solicitor's his day job, which he probably shouldn't give up. But he's played by Michael Hadley. So it would be Lear. He's a Lear Monkey, isn't it?
Yes, he's an actor who wishes he was Lear, and he tries to get his revenge on Jefferson by selling a story to the tabloids, and then he instructs the solicitor to sue them. And there's a speech which is essentially bridging two larger scenes in which the solicitor rings up the newspapers, and it's entirely from, you know, our experience.
Your experience.
Yes, all right, I was just trying to broaden it. But basically it's my experience of having people ring up and demand large amounts of money from you. And the night we went, that speech got a round of applause, and I was just looking round saying, this isn't funny.
I could see why it would... Oh, yes, it is, I'll say. My best pantomime riposte.
When it came to write that speech, it was one of the things that came out of the rehearsal process and the read-through, and we needed just some bits of speeches to carry us into the next act. And Ian was able to just trip out all these Latin phrases like scandalum magnatum and libellus formosus, which I didn't know what they meant, but Ian assured me that they were very, very important.
They're Latin phrases to try and, if you're a solicitor, to try and boost up the amount of damages. You put a lot of Latin in. And then all judges quote the scene from Othello, who steals reputation, steals trash.
Yes, I think, yes, and that's a lovely one to use in this collection of Shakespearean thespians.
Absolutely.
So that really worked, yes.
But I have sat through it a few times.
What, Othello?
Judges telling me that there's this bit in Othello.
I love the idea of you sitting there and the judge probably showing off almost because he knows he's got Ian Hislop there. So, yeah. Now, let's just go back to the nuts and bolts of this play. You've got lucky, I think, to have Caroline Leslie directing it. She is so nifty on her feet as a director, isn't she? The whole thing flows brilliantly. And she knows the watermill. In fact, you've got a lot of watermill stalwarts there, haven't you? One of the reasons they work so well together, cast at the watermill, is that they go and live down there. It's sort of like being at boarding school for actors, which is absolutely great, and I'm kind of jealous of that.
We were very jealous. I mean, the night we went down there and got to hang around with the actors a bit in the bar and then watch them going off to just stay down there, and we went back to our lives, we thought, this is fabulous.
I think it helps get that wonderful sort of feeling of ensemble going as well. They all get on very well together and seem to have a good time, and that happily is reflected on the stage.
Certainly is.
Yes, I believe Hedda Beebe, who's the artistic director at the Watermill, was very keen to get in a director who knows how, you know, that theatre can work in terms of the mechanics of it. And she was, I mean, very inspired. I mean, the three moments in the play I enjoyed most when I went to see it, we didn't write. they're just physical stuff from the director.
What were they?
There was Nigel literally upstaging Jefferson Steele by standing in front of him and delivering his lines.
That was absolutely wonderful. I really, yes, that's one where I fell about, so yes.
A bit where Jefferson, at his lowest ebb, when he's been drinking and abandoned by everyone, he then thinks, what would the character I usually play in the Hollywood movies do? And that gave us a logic which we certainly hadn't thought of.
Yeah, that's great.
And when Mary, supposedly singing a fool's song, sang it in a flamenco outfit and then danced, which was just marvellous, but that's just direction.
Yeah, she'd come home from her flamenco class, yeah. Well, because that's what, it was lovely, because they all had hinterlands, even though they were sort of comic characters. They weren't caricatures. Your on-stage director, Dorothy Nettle, her name, she's played by the most amazing actress, Jackie Morrison, who really does have this sort of empathy and ability to boss people around tactfully. I mean, this is the role, but she plays it absolutely perfectly. I don't know if she was actually observing her own director.
Probably. It's probably a reflection of Caroline. She's a sort of beautiful English rose, so you believe the romance. She's got a fabulous singing voice. Yeah, so
giving a bit away there.
But plot spoiler. But she also, there's a line in it we were particularly proud of. The rehearsal's getting out of hand, and she says, if everyone goes on behaving badly, then I'm going to... And she doesn't know what she's going to do, and then she just says, cry. It seemed to be a very, very sort of English way of directing middle-aged men.
I have to say, as somebody English who has directed middle-aged men, yes, wanting to cry does it for me, yeah. Let's talk about also the set. Your designer, Tom Rogers, he also worked at the Waterworld before. I think people love working there because of that challenge. And the stage is ridiculously small. There's no depth. There's nothing. There's a bit of height. And there's that wonderful connection with the audience because you've got this sweeping balcony that goes all the way around. So you can use that. And they just rise to the occasion every time. So we've got this... You describe your amazing set and how those scene changes are covered by fabulous music. Paul Herbert's wonderful music, some that I think adapted from music I've heard before for Shakespeare and his contemporaries, but wonderful way. It makes every scene change into a virtue.
Well, I think... I mean, we first went to the Watermill to see various productions, and I thought, well, it's a barn, it's a square space, and as you say, it's not very big and it doesn't do very much. And we thought, well, that's it then, that's one set. And then you start seeing what they can do with that in terms of literally folding out the walls and creating a bed and breakfast. And our designer just made space where I didn't believe it was possible. And that's covered by, I mean... Again, we knew we would have to do this. And I've always liked the Fool's songs in Lear, which I think are beautiful. And we thought, well, there's enough of them that we can actually have a song to cover every scene change. And then Paul Herbert wrote the music, which again is very wistful and very melancholy. And it's a great counterpoint to the jokes we've tried to tell.
Yeah, because also when you dim the lights for a scene change and you just spot one of the cast, and it's not just one of the cast, I think pretty well all of them get to sing. They're very good at that too, which is lovely. But as you say, it just shifts the mood a bit. So you have a tiny rest from laughing and you think, oh, it's lovely what I'm listening
to. We hadn't actually written them as songs. We imagined they would probably be done as verse, but with maybe a little music behind. But when we got to the read-through and Caroline Leslie said, they can all sing, all our cast can sing. And rather beautifully, and she wasn't joking, you know, they are amazing voices. And that's one of the surprises that Caroline has brought to the production, is turning, one interviewer asked us, why don't you do it as a musical? And we said, well, actually, it is a bit of a musical. Paul's music is, I think, just stunning. And he's added a sort of rousing song right after the curtain call, which sends you out with a big smile on your face. One of Caroline's previous shows that she had done for the Watermill was Thoroughly Modern Millie. Mm.
Oh, God, that was so wonderful.
Eleanor Brown, who plays Jefferson's daughter beautifully in our... she plays Jessica Steele. She was Millie in... and so, you know, they can do it.
Yeah, she's a lovely, fresh presence, actually.
She's just wonderful, sort of ingenue. Yeah.
I think that's what's so lovely for Pace, that you've got your little collection of amateurs, you've got the bombshell of the big star arriving and all the rest of it, and then just when I think I like the way you bring on, I was going to call them the two blondes, but that sounds terribly sexist. I don't know if that, but you've got the rather sexy wife of the sponsor, who is an ale company, and she's doing the PR. It's played by Emily Bowker. She does physiotherapy on the side as well, which is rather lovely and very important. And then, of course, you've got Jessica, the daughter, who's a very neglected daughter up till this time. And I just think that's just where you needed some other people. Were those roles in the original film?
No, I mean, we changed the role of the daughter a lot. She comes in much later in the film and isn't there. And that's one of the real strengths, I think, of the play version is the daughter is there as part of his life who he has to deal with. But I think you've just got to the point in a play where you've set up the characters, you've set up what's happening, and you've got the idea that this American star is there and he's rather ghastly. And then she arrives and suddenly it's a note of reality. I mean, he's not just on his own. He has some baggage and he has to cope with it.
And, of course, you immediately reveal that she's majored in acting. So I guess we all knew she probably... I don't think I'm giving anything away to say she lands up as Cordelia, because you're dying for her to play... I was gagging for her to play Cordelia as much as she was. So it's all sort of there. Everybody has to double in the daftest way possible. And I think we're possibly used to the idea of Fool and Cordelia doubling, but possibly not with the director as well. And I can't remember that I was right about Goneril and Regan both being played by the same person. Probably not. But there's a ridiculous amount of doubling that's actually not possible.
I think we got quite lost in it as we went through. There are various people who are very important to the play who you never see, like the Duke of Cornwall, who's never there, and he's the one who appears by Skype. And it gets quite confusing, but I don't think that really... that matters too much in terms of Amdram plays, which there have been productions where I think Goneril and Regan have been played by the same actress, half a costume dividing the two characters. So she just turns around and she's one minute and one the other. So I think that you can have a lot of fun with it. One of the things about that you were saying about the structure of the play and how the characters are sort of brought in, our agent, Jodie Shields from Casarotto Ramsay, sort of having read the play, Casarotto Ramsay are very good. They do a lot because of the Ramsay bit is Peggy Ramsay. Oh. So there's a lot of background in theatre in our agency. They made us sort of sit down and look at some Akeborn plays and see how he would structure a play. And that's one of the things we learnt very much from him. He's sort of something of a... He's quite good at it, I suppose. He's a master. And seeing how he introduces characters one by one, how you... Every time you introduce a new character, the whole dynamics of the play changes, because everybody has a different attitude then to all the different characters as they come on stage. Very interesting exercise.
Back in a way, I suppose, to what you must have learnt in the last 30 years, the running joke. God, do I love the running joke. You have two brilliant running jokes in this, at least. There's probably more. But one of them is the idea that Mary is absolutely potty about. She's a total fan of Jefferson Steele, but she manages to mix him up with every other action hero. And she mentions so many films, like, oh, you were amazing in Raiders of the Lost Ark or The Sixth Sense or whatever it was. And he is increasingly infuriated by having to say, no, that was Bruce Willis, that was Harrison Ford. That was fabulous.
Mary is a very sort of modern Mrs. Malaprop, I think. and I think we've all got elderly relatives who keep saying, oh yes, wasn't he in that other thing? No, you were. And we just thought that having him in the flesh, constantly being humiliated by people not knowing who he is, I think it's happened to even very famous people in this room, I think.
Really?
Well, I have to say, the number of times people say to me, oh, you're really good in QI. And I say, oh. I've never been on QI. Oh yeah, but Mock the Week. Now that's funny. I'm not on that one. Oh, really? Would I lie to you? You said that's... No, that's David Mitchell. There is a bit of my own life that sneaks in there.
Right. Actually, I hate to sort of brown nose you or anything like that, but I do prefer Have I Got News for you to all of it.
You see, now that Mary would never say that.
And actually, can I just take issue? I don't think Mary came over as elderly. I think she was still in the prime of life.
No, it was just more the the reality of it is that people, probably maybe somebody of Mary's youthful age, we probably might get it right from time to time. But no, it's just more the generic type of I'm terrible at names and
you're not very old.
No.
Right, and the other wonderful running joke, and also there may be others, is you've got a fabulous character. I think he's supposed to be building sets. Dennis Dobbins. It's such a nice name, Dennis Dobbins. I have the names as well. I hope you came up with those, did you?
Yes.
Yeah, really good. And Dennis, he's obviously one of these people who's got to work out, you know, he's a problem solver. How do you put out your eyes on stage. And he comes up with ever more repulsive ways of doing it. And I love that as well, because we're always waiting for the next one, aren't we?
Yes, it was a way of making it not too wordy and too literally, because there are people who like theatre because you can do effects and you can make people gasp. And Dennis is obviously... wants to be Gloucester solely so that he can find a way of getting the eyes out in a really horrible way. So we just kept doing it.
Now, two questions. Has this play got a future? Because it seems a shame. I'm sure it will sell out in Newbury, but I'm just worried about it coming into London, because what would happen to it in a great big London theatre? Where could it go? What can you do with it? Will you do something with it?
That's rather up to David Parfitt, our producer. I think it would be marvellous to tour it. Mm. I can think of 100 theatres in Britain where I would love to see this play. They don't necessarily involve going into the West End. I just think it would be terrific in all sorts of smaller venues.
And do you think that the amateurs would be queuing up to do it? Because I think they might.
I think there has been a little bit of interest in that respect. I mean, one of David's thoughts right from the start when we were talking about doing it, he said, wouldn't it be fantastic to get local Amdrams companies involved in doing it? And I think he thought that if we ever got to a stage where we would tour, it would take on a slightly different role. You're actually doing something, giving a bit back to the community as well as sort of celebrating the community.
You mean as a supernumerary? Like you have quite a lot of people who play backstage staff.
But
I thought
they
maybe
played the people who came to audition for
yes,
the part.
And they, so they all had their moment, which was lovely.
Pretty funny.
Yeah, and good moments, yeah. So I think that's... Yeah, that's what you mean. But I also thought, once it's had its massive tour of the UK, I think you might find amateur groups queuing up to actually do the whole play.
That would be fantastic. I just love the idea. I mean, it is one of the lovely things about this whole experience is that Ian and I are so used to doing television and radio, where television, you get a big shot of an audience, but it sort of disappears into the ether. Every night for the next month, we've got people doing this, and it varies. You know, you'll have good nights, you'll have not so good nights, I should imagine. But it's just a wonderful thought that it's got a life of its own. And gosh, it would be fantastic if that life extended beyond the watermill.
So finally, has it whetted your appetites to write some more plays?
Oh, very much. You can't sit in a full theatre with people enjoying what you've written without thinking, ooh, should we do this again?
And they're likely to be comedies then, by the sound of it.
I think we like comedies that have a sort of a slight undertow. There's a hint of melancholy about.
This recent TV drama, The Wipers Times, which is about the First World War, which... we started writing as a play because we thought we'll never get it on television. So we'd, by the time BBC Two actually commissioned it, they read the treatment and commissioned it, we'd written nearly a third of it as a play. So that's something that we would very, very much like to have another crack at, because that's a very theatrical piece.
Well, you heard it here first on Theatre Voice. Look out for The Wipers Times on stage near you as well. Thank you so much, Nick and Ian, for talking to me for Theatre Voice.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you very much.